The path to setting things right in this economy is going to have to wind through hundreds of years of history. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the ninth day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The thing about systemic economic racism, the underlying cause of so much of what we've been seeing in this country the past 10 days, is that to understand it, and one hopes to fix it, is that you have to know your history. So we are going to do a little history to start things off today. A story from Kimberly Adams about the early days of American capitalism and how we keep track of it to this day. Kimberly spent some time a couple of years ago at Thomas Jefferson's plantation talking to historian Caitlin Rosenthal about her book, Accounting for Slavery.
Even on the rainiest of summer days, Monticello is still busy, with hundreds of tourists wandering the expansive grounds and gardens of Jefferson's plantation in central Virginia. Caitlin Rosenthal, under an umbrella, views the rain as kind of perfect.
Account books always begin with the weather. Often it's raining and people are still in the fields. I mean, it's really wet, but it's not torrential, so people are probably still working.
The people she's talking about were slaves, or more accurately, people enslaved by plantation owners like Thomas Jefferson. Rosenthal is an assistant professor of history at UC Berkeley. She spent the last decade digging through plantation account books from the 1700s and 1800s, studying how slavery worked. Even after spending so much time immersed in those details, she still finds it jarring every time she visits a plantation. We start, along with some tourists, on Monticello's Mulberry Row, the former site of the plantation's many workshops, where the weaving, woodworking, and smithing were done.
What is that?
The bellows. Oh.
Rosenthal says slaves would have operated those bellows in the reconstructed blacksmith shop. They did most of the skilled work here.
So thinking about enslaved people as capital meant that if you trained them as blacksmiths or something like that, you might increase their value to you.
And slaveholders tracked their human assets with a level of detail similar to what you see in modern accounting techniques, adjusting values upward as children grew into working adults and learned new skills.
But then also on the backside, keeping track of their depreciation in value as they grow older, if they're injured. And these relatively sophisticated valuations even extend to people sometimes receiving a negative value.
Negative because the cost to slaveholders of keeping the person alive was greater than the profit their labor could produce. We follow a gravel walkway from Mulberry Row and up the hill towards Jefferson's home. As we walk, the part of the estate where the workshops and slave quarters once stood slowly disappears below the sightline. From the patio just off Jefferson's library, the view is sweeping and beautiful, mountains and valleys. The disconnect between the slaveholder and his property is intentional.
So this is just like my experience being in the space, is just to remind yourself of the extent of the power imbalances that are everywhere.
Jefferson's library, think of it as the corner office of the plantation, contains hundreds of leather-bound volumes, many of them accounting ledgers and farm records. Nia Bates is public historian of slavery and African-American life at Monticello. She says Jefferson kept meticulous accounts.
He would write nuclear family groups together, so that's helped us with the genealogical research. He would write out their rations, so we're able to know what they're getting.
And this is how historians have traditionally used these records, to examine the lives of the slaves. At Monticello, they're being used to inform a new series of exhibits that more accurately depicts the lives of those enslaved there. But Bates says these records also tell the story of the business of the plantation.
Monticello was an economic enterprise, and that's how Jefferson was making the majority of his money. So the labor of enslaved people here is really the economic basis of Jefferson's wealth.
Caitlin Rosenthal says the cotton plantations further south and the sugar plantations in the Caribbean were even more advanced than Monticello. Their records reminded Rosenthal of spreadsheets she used in her previous job as a management consultant, advising companies on how to improve productivity.
In some cases, innovation was a byproduct of bondage. Planters were making really sophisticated business decisions about, of course, this most horrifying and totally commodified human body.
Decisions based on what we think of today as data, handwritten in neat columns. Food allowed, rest allowed, working conditions, pounds of cotton picked or sugar harvested, human value tracked right alongside the value of livestock.
There was this idea that if you just found the right data and brought the right tools, that you could increase output. And this is like the core idea that I think you find management consultants taking to businesses today.
But unlike businesses of today, slaveholders had complete control over workers' lives and limitless power to experiment with different methods to increase productivity.
One of the most harrowing would have been punishing slaves who fell short.
In ways that are familiar, yet remain deeply disturbing, like whipping.
Like for every pound they fell short of a target, they might receive one lash. So each incremental pound is incentivized by that little bit of violence.
Some slaveholders used less violent incentives, even rewards, more food, extra clothing.
There are even cases where planters apparently ran contests where they would offer a prize because planters were trying to use every bit of that labor potential from child to adult.
Rosenthal says the account books also reveal stories of resistance, slaves working more slowly or hiding their true abilities. But she says those stories are nearly buried under the weight of the human toll documented in the thousands of yellowed plantation records that still exist. One set of records in particular has stayed with her. They detailed the value of children. Two of those children had the same names as Rosenthal's young son and daughter, Edward and Eliza.
To look at that list and see the values attached to their names and the fact that I get to have no prices attached to my kids is like an incredible and privilege that none of these people had.
Children, according to one accounting formula, should be valued at $25 at birth, $75 at their first birthday, add $25 a year until they turn 10, and from there, the market price. At Monticello, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We've got more about Kimberly's conversation with historian Caitlin Rosenthal from a couple of years ago on our website. It is, of course, marketplace.org. We learned yesterday, I mentioned it on the way out, I think, that we are, as of February, officially in a recession. We learned that fact from the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research. Now, why do we need a committee to tell us we're in a recession? And assuming we do need a committee, that is, why that committee in particular? Who decided that they get to decide? We asked Marketplace's Sabri Benishore to look into that one.
We don't need a committee to tell us if it's raining, so why do we need one to tell us if we're in a recession?
The definition of a recession is kind of qualitative.
Ben Herzon is an executive director at IHS Market. There are a bunch of criteria for recession. Sustained economic contraction spread across the economy for more than a few months. This time, what with the pandemic, it was pretty obvious, but sometimes it's really not.
There's a lot of judgment involved.
So who should make that judgment call? I mean, I guess the government could. James Stock teaches economics at Harvard.
But if you just think for a minute about the conflict of interest that that poses, that just doesn't seem like a very good choice.
So why not have the folks who pretty much came up with the whole idea of studying business cycles in the first place do it? That would be the National Bureau of Economic Research, founded 100 years ago.
That research program back in the 1920s and 1930s establish the concepts of recessions and expansions and business cycles.
Now, you may have noticed that it is June now. It feels like the committee took its sweet time to announce a recession that started in February. But that's actually quick for the NBER. Jeremy Piger is a professor of economics at the University of Oregon.
Clearly, saying that a recession started, say, a year ago, which is what they did with the 2008 recession, is not super useful from a policy perspective.
Like the Fed is going to wait for months to do anything. But it does provide a record for people who study literally the guts of how the economy works.
You can think of that as being useful for everywhere from, for, you know, like a high school textbook, all the way up to sort of cutting edge economic research.
You might not need a doctor to tell you you're sick, but you sure would like to figure out what you had. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Recession or not, there's a whole lot we don't know about what this economy is going to look like after the pandemic tops out. But a lot of industries are already working on it. The last couple of days have brought some reporting that the whole business model for giant oil drilling companies is being rethought. Marketplace's Scott Song reports that some of the big questions are about support from investors and consumer demand once things are closer to normal.
In the oil biz, IOC stands for International Oil Company, and it's the O, oil, that's been under threat as climate change policies kick in. Economist Mark Finley is a fellow at Rice University.
But I think also we're seeing that the broader forces of deglobalization, which is also accelerated by the COVID-19 crisis, may be putting the I under threat as well.
That means less international business, less shipping, less flying, given recent trade wars and travel bans. And all that means, of course, less burning of oil. In an interview today, the CEO of Shell says he does not expect world demand to come back soon. And Ryan Lance, the CEO of ConocoPhillips, told IHS Market in an interview that U.S. production of crude may never return to its pre-pandemic peak.
I would probably, if I was a betting man today, it would be pretty difficult for us to return to 13 million barrels a day.
A lot of cranky oil and gas investors might agree. Fossil fuels have been the market's worst performer for years. Researcher Mark Lewis at BNP Paribas Asset Management says renewable energy stocks fetched double the price of oil shares.
And if investors are telling you that they want to see more renewables investments rather than oil investments, you know, the writing is on the wall.
Many oil companies are moving to more environmentally friendly kinds of energy, like natural gas and wind. Still, Mark Finley at Rice says we need to be humble calling a turning point.
For everyone in New York or San Francisco who wants to sit at home and work from home, there's somebody in the emerging world who aspires to own a car.
Oil executives know that. But for now, several are signaling that their longtime business model is changing. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
A lot of our comfort food items have been very popular.
If ever there were times that call for comfort food, am I right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lost 300 points today, 1%, 27,272. That's a lot of twos and sevens. The NASDAQ inched up above the 10,000 mark for just a little bit for the first time today. In the end, though, added 29 points, 0.2%, 99.53. The S&P 500 down 25 points, about 0.7%, 32.07. Retail has been struggling, as you know, but Macy's says several hundred of its stores that have reopened are doing better than anticipated. That was an update to its first quarter results. Still, Macy's shares dressed down more than 7%, Nordstrom off 9.8% today. IBM says it's getting out of the facial recognition business, concerned about how that technology could be used for mass surveillance and racial profiling. Today, IBM tracked down 2.8%. Bond prices rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 0.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit, with whom you'll find a couple of interviews in the archives of this program, has resigned after a picture showing him in brownface circulated on social media, first posted by his wife, it turns out. At the same time, current and former staffers of that magazine accused it of underpaying people of color. Condé Nast, the parent company, said it goes to, and this is a quote, great lengths to ensure that employees are paid fairly. The specific example of Bon Appetit aside, though, if a company is serious about racial and ethnic pay equity, what should it actually be doing? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is on that one.
The first part's pretty basic. It's hard to fix what you don't measure. Companies can start by collecting the data. Adia Harvey Wingfield teaches sociology at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri.
You'll see many researchers say that if companies really want to address diversity and inclusion, set hard targets, set specific goals. Treat this as you would any other metric in a company.
You can measure the pay gap in different ways. You could do an average of the salaries of all employees, broken down by race and ethnicity, or go position by position. Marketing manager, level 3, what is everybody making? Kelly McElhaney, who directs the Center for Equity, Gender, and Leadership at UC Berkeley, says companies should also publish their data.
Pain is the fastest driver. We know that there is not gender or racial pay equity, period. We know that. So let's just not hide behind the numbers. Let's get them out there.
And she says they should make a public commitment to pay equity and hold managers accountable for it.
If Mary in this organization has a 2% pay gap and Mark in this business unit has a 12% pay gap, then Mark's comp has got to be tied to, are you achieving the goal that we have set for us as a company? If it's not, he's got to feel it.
Also, Catherine Giscombe, who runs the research and consulting firm Giscombe & Associates, says companies should set clear, objective criteria for where an employee falls in the salary range for a position, because too often bias creeps in.
If it's, well, I just see this person as being at the upper level of the scale. I really like this guy. He reminds me of my family. I mean, obviously, people wouldn't like literally say something like that, but that could be the basis for their biased recommendation that someone get a higher level of pay.
And she recommends changing the performance review process. So employees are evaluated by multiple colleagues of various ethnic and racial backgrounds when they're going for a raise or promotion. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
You don't have to squint too hard to see that this might be one of those moments that turns out to be an actual moment where things change, or start to change anyway, in some really big ways. We've still got a pandemic going on in this country, protests and uprisings that just kind of feel different, and globally a move to reduce American participation, economic and otherwise. So we've called Tori Taussig. She's the research director at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Kennedy School at Harvard. We called her up to talk things over. Tori, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
What do you make, and let's start big picture here, what do you make of this moment in this country with all that's going on and the idea of American influence abroad?
Well, this is certainly a moment of reckoning for the United States at home and abroad. Let's take a step back, even before the protests started, to talk about how the United States was dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. And I think that there are two important issues to focus on. The first is that the pandemic has reprioritized and energized efforts in the United States and elsewhere to nationalize supply chains. And the second issue I wanted to focus on is the United States and other countries may take protectionist measures in order to boost domestic industries. And I think, you know, this will, of course, have a negative effect on global trade routes. We're likely to see a turn toward protectionism moving forward.
So let's take it from the foreign point of view here for a minute. And if you're a traditional American ally, let's say you are Angela Merkel in Germany, or let's say you're Japan, and you're looking at how this country is handling the coronavirus pandemic, the protests, and its general attitude toward international affairs from the Trump administration, what is your gut telling you?
There's been a general sadness and dismay, I think, among American allies that they have lost their traditional partner in solving big global issues, whether they be on pandemics or economic crises. And it's clear that the Trump administration and our government is distracted by major economic and health crisis here at home and now protests that are inhibiting our ability to be a stronger voice for these values overseas.
What's at risk in this moment for Or, you know, depending on your answer, is there anything at risk in this moment for America's position as a globally economically dominant player? What's on the line?
Well, there are many ways that the U.S. carries out influence abroad, economic and otherwise. I worry that this is a time where we're seeing our convening power, our coalition building power, severely reduced, whether that be because of distraction at home or the Trump administration's lack of interest in working with European allies. I mean, we saw early on in this pandemic, the United States block consensus statements coming out of the G7 and the G20 because allies weren't getting on board with blaming or punishing China enough. The European Union carried out a series of fundraising efforts last month to raise money for coronavirus vaccine research. The United States' voice was absent. They didn't contribute to the funding. And so these are just two examples of how the U.S. voice has been reduced on the world stage, where allies have traditionally looked for the U.S. to play a bigger leadership role and convening role.
Tori Tosig, she's a research director at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Kennedy School at Harvard. Tori, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Thank you, Kai.
We did a story on here yesterday about the dismal number of black CEOs of the biggest companies in this economy. Only four in all 500 of the Fortune 500. Today, we're talking slightly smaller companies.
My name is Nicoa Evans Hendricks, and I am a co-founder and the executive director of Harlem Park to Park, which is an alliance of about 250 entrepreneurs in Harlem. We represent restaurants, retail stores, cultural institutions, services, nonprofits, the whole gamut of businesses that really make up, you know, sort of the heartbeat of a community. In addition, I am also the owner of a restaurant called Ruby's Vintage. The recent, you know, killing of George Floyd has shaken the entire world. And in a community like Harlem that is so, you know, the capital of Black America, for us, it's been especially tragic to see something like this happen. What's also been an interesting kind of development as a result of this is that there's been an increased interest in Black-owned businesses. Certainly, as a Black-owned business with Ruby's Vintage, we've seen benefits in that increased traffic on our platforms, increased interest in ordering food from the restaurant. And really, in this time, you know, people are anxiety-ridden. People are really seeking dishes that are really comforting as well. So a lot of our comfort food items have been very popular. The restaurant itself was inspired by Ruby Dee, the legendary actress, who was widely known for her activism. And so that's kind of built into the DNA of our brand. So this is certainly a time where that, as a mission and as a part of who we are, be prevalent. And so that's been good to be recognized for that.
That was Nicoa Evans Hendricks. She is the co-owner of Ruby's Vintage. That's a restaurant in Harlem. She is also a co-founder of Harlem Park to Park. That's an alliance representing entrepreneurs in Harlem. Tell us, would you, when you get a minute in these crazy times, what's going on in your economy? You can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, maybe tech doesn't have all the answers edition. Among the casualties of this pandemic and the ensuing social distancing guidelines, the selfie. Tough to do right, 6 feet apart, right? Unless you've got really long arms. Anyway, Apple, of course, was given a patent on a solution earlier this month, although they did start working on it a couple of years ago, to be fair. It's called a synthetic group selfie. Basically, erases other people's backgrounds, merges their selfies into yours, and there you go. Instant synthetic memory. All right, we got to go, but first, your moment of economic context on this Tuesday, and it comes courtesy of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. In one of its regular reports out this week, the New York Fed says, and here is the quote, consumers grew comparatively, emphasis mine, more optimistic about labor market outcomes with earnings growth, job finding, and job loss expectations all slightly improving. Still, and although the New York Fed says all of those key indicators are way below where they were in the before times. Speaking of the Fed, by the way, Jay Powell and the gang at the Federal Open Market Committee wrap up a meeting tomorrow. We will, of course, because it's our job, let you know what they say. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcoat, Sarah Menendez, Eliza Mills, and Janet Wynn. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Lily here to say a special thanks to those businesses and organizations that sponsor Marketplace. This support is what fuels our reporting and allows our independent journalism to thrive. If you think your business would benefit from sponsoring Marketplace, check out marketplace.org/corporate. Fill out the short form and someone from Marketplace will follow up. That's marketplace.org/corporate.